I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. May and June are peak times for bird song, so it's a great time to hear birds. And if we're lucky, we get to see them, too. Ornithologist Vernon Locks joins us from our studio at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. Good morning, Vern.
Good morning, Mindy. What a beautiful day it is.
It is. And look, we can hear the birds.
You know, this time of year is just, it's magical, really. And I get the bad thing about May is it's only 31 days long. You wish that there's just such intense bird activity with the migration of all the little songbirds that breed up in the boreal forest, all the returning birds that come to nest and start proclaiming their back and their singing. And it's just kind of action-packed.
Yeah, just even in your own backyard. I mean, I've been standing out in the yard and all kinds of activity going on.
Yeah, I mean, it's really, you really don't want to be inside at this time of year. Or anytime I'm in having to work on the computer, I have all the windows open so I can sort of, I feel like a radar unit listening to all the birds out there. It's great.
Right. And as you've said many times, we hear more of them than we actually see. So being able to hear and identify by sound, I'm still learning a lot of that myself. But you start with some of the easy ones and, you know, before you know it, you can tell who's in your yard.
Yeah. We're actually, I don't know, we're kind of lucky because the Cape and Islands really doesn't, we don't have that many breeding species. The total number, not like out in the woodlands, if you were living up in northwestern Massachusetts or up in Vermont, you've got almost nothing all winter. And then, you know, 22 species of warblers, 4 species of vireos, 4 species of thrushes come in. And the song, it can be quite a challenge to learn all those songs. But here, if you learn the birds that are singing in your yard, the American robin, the cardinal, the song sparrow, the Carolina wren. I mean, if you learn 4 or 5 of the common songs, pretty soon you're going to start realizing that you're able to know what 80 or 90% of what you're hearing is. And then hopefully that will have sparked an interest. And then when you hear something you don't know, you go run it down. And pretty soon you better be careful because you're going to be a birder. That's what happened to you.
So. Yes, it is. And I'm going to tell you what happened to me in just a second. I want to give the phone number so those who want to call in and tell us their bird stories or questions, 866-999-4626. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I had never put up hummingbird feeders before. As you know, I have a lot of flowers and, you know, when the season comes, I always have hummingbirds.
You have a lovely yard and a terrific garden.
for the hummingbirds, you know, so I thought, well, why do I need to put up hummingbird feeders? But this time of year, there isn't much in bloom. So I decided for the first time I was going to put up a hummingbird feeder. I now have 3, Vern, because I had some activity. As you know, a pair of Baltimore Orioles came in. I have never seen a Baltimore Oriole in my yard before. So it was so exciting that I got
to
have
more. Did they come to the hummingbird feeder?
They did. They came to the hummingbird. Yeah. And I put it, you know, orange out, and they seemed to want the hummingbird feeder more than the orange, which was interesting. But I thought it was funny because my husband said, how do you know about the orange? I said, Vern. Hang around, you learn this stuff.
You know what you can do to the orange now that it's a little older or something? Just sort of hollow out the middle and put some grape jelly in there. And the Orioles and anything that's there, they love, and the catbirds, they'll come in for the jelly.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
Which I'm doing over here, and it's really quite funny. I mean, they get it really tame. They'll come within 2 or 3 feet of me.
Yeah, they're so beautiful, that bright orange. Now, they were there, it was a couple Saturdays ago. Just that day, I saw them, you know, throughout the afternoon, and then they moved on. Where were they going?
They're actually kind of scarce in the Cape and Islands because we don't really have big enough trees and the right habitat. I mean, there's 4 pairs of Baltimore Orioles that nest on Nantucket. The Vineyard's got more, and certain areas on the Cape with larger trees as the trees are getting bigger. But if you go inland, like anywhere in suburban Boston, the Orioles are just abundant, and they're in all the shade trees. So. Mm. They were still going further north and west of here.
That was pretty exciting.
They were probably migrants that just dropped in and really hungry. And those oranges, you know, to them, that color just, they go right to them.
Well, you know, I didn't have the oranges out until I saw them. But it's a red hummingbird feeder, red glass. So maybe they saw the red and said, let's see what that is.
Yeah, there's something. Hummingbirds really, really prefer red, the red color. I mean, they see all sorts of wavelengths and ultraviolet stuff that we cannot detect at all. I mean, we're almost blind compared to the spectrum that a hummingbird sees. And I whenever I'm in the tropics birding in Ecuador, so if you try to wear, I wear like a red shirt or a red hat, and all day long, hummingbirds come in and buzz you. They come in because they're attracted by the red.
Oh, that's funny.
So you've got, it's like, whew, all these birds are zipping around. It's very neat.
So hummingbirds are back. How long do you keep the feeders up?
Well, if you have hummingbirds nest here in small numbers. Some places on the Cape actually have quite a few, and they will utilize the feet. They not only are they getting water, but they're getting a little energy from it. What is your mix? Like one quarter sugar?
Quarter sugar and the rest water, yeah.
And four parts water?
Yep. Maybe a little less water. I've given them
quite
a bit of sugar.
Right, that's what they recommend. Yeah. I try it. Sometimes I make it too strong.
Yeah.
I don't know if that works. Anyway, if you've got hummingbirds, keep the feeders going. But a lot of the hummingbirds are passing through.
Mm-hmm.
It seems sort of counterintuitive to think that, like, I used to go up to Prince Edward Island, which is, 900 miles north of here. And in the summer, it's much colder up there. It's very different. But the hummingbirds are unbelievable. They're all ruby throats. But when I used to go up in June and put a feeder up, I'd have as many as 30 or 40
wow.
hummingbirds at the feeder. Mm-hmm. And it seems really odd to me that as you go north, you would have more hummingbirds breeding. And anyway, I think a lot of that is there's less insects up there. There's much less many wasps and things that are utilizing the nectar sources. And hummingbirds also eat lots and lots of insects and spiders. That's what they feed their young.
Yes. So should I leave them up until the flowers are out, or do you leave
is
them?
Is that
up?
What you were asking me?
Yeah, I'm just wondering. Like, do I leave them out? I don't leave them out all summer.
No, leave
do
them,
I?
Leave them out until you don't see if are the hummingbirds coming every day.
Yes.
Okay, well, I think you probably have hummingbirds nesting in your neighborhood.
I wouldn't be surprised because we remember it was a few years back when I saw the little baby hummingbirds, so maybe they're back. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I think they're nesting nearby, and so keep the feeders up, and, it's their hummingbirds are just so amazing anyway to watch.
Great,
my God.
Yeah. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number for your bird questions or stories. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Tell us about these birdathons that have been going on.
Yeah, the birdathon was something that was started, I don't know, 35 or 40 years ago. I think Mass Audubon started the birdathon idea as a way to raise funds for bird conservation. So basically each sanctuary gets people, they get people to pledge so much, either a fixed amount or I'll give you $1 for every species of bird you see or $5 or whatever. So what they do, and for Mass Audubon, the boundaries are Massachusetts. So the Wellfleet Bay Sanctuary, which I actually did the birdathon for them on Nantucket, as well as ran a birdathon for the Lindoloring Nature Foundation and Mariah Mitchell Association. There's nothing that says you can't raise funds for more than one organization when you're doing it.
Right.
They put teams out all over Massachusetts, and you go. It's a 24-hour deal. It starts 6 p.m. on Friday night right through 6 p.m. Saturday afternoon. So you get, actually, that's more civilized than some of the big days you do for the American Birding Association, which are midnight to midnight. So you can get wherever you want to be and start at 6 o'clock. Say you want to go to someplace that's hard to reach it. You can leave at 3 and get there by 6. The clock starts at 6. You start counting all these different species. Really, the trick is try to visit as many different habitats and find all as many different species of birds as you can. So
it's almost like it's kind of like the Christmas bird count.
It is, but it's a little actually. And it's funny on Nantucket here. We had horrible weather last weekend. We started. I mean, we got first. It was southeast winds blowing at 30 miles an hour, 40 degrees all night long. So we couldn't really hear any owls calling. We were very lucky to find whippoorwill. We only had one woodcock that we could just barely hear over the screaming wind. I mean, the weather conditions really worked against us. But we also found a snow goose, which is should be up on the tundra breeding, which is really late. I think it's the latest record ever for Nantucket. We found a snowy owl, which was amazing. I hadn't seen one in weeks, but this would certainly be the spring you would think for a snowy owl to linger. And we found one out in the cranberry bogs here.
Hmm.
And we ended up
a little
actually,
egret, right?
What's that?
It was a little egret too, right?
Right. The next afternoon, we found a bird called a tricolored heron, which is very common on the Gulf Coast, but quite rare in Massachusetts, and really rare on Nantucket. And we found one of those. And a little later, somebody that went to look for the tricolored heron at the marsh found a little egret, which is a, when it's not really a little egret. It looks exactly like a snowy egret, but it has a couple of differences. It has, snowy egret has a shaggy crest on the back of its head, and the little egret has these two little plumes that come off. And then the lores, but that's the bare skin between the eye and the beak, on a snowy egret is yellow. On a little egret, it's gray, and it also, and its bill is a little longer and thicker. But otherwise, it's white, it's got black legs, it's got the same bright yellow feet. Unless you really took a really good look at it with a scope, you would just call it a snowy egret. Anyway, little egrets are basically conspecific with snowies. They winter in Africa and breed in Europe and Asia. So
that was exciting.
It's only one of a handful of records for North America.
Oh.
So that was a really, that was probably the rarest bird seen on any of the birdathons.
That's exciting.
So we managed on Nantucket to find 120 species
wow.
of birds, which given the weather, that's about
good.
What we find on the Christmas bird count total. So there's just as many species here or more in the winter than there are, which is really,
that's interesting.
Count doesn't seem possible,
yeah.
but it is. And Wellfleet Bay, I just talked to Mark Faraday this morning, their science director down there, and they ended up with their teams all over the state. I forget how many teams they had. They ended up with 225 species
wow.
on the birdathon.
That's great.
That's amazing.
Yeah,
that's great.
Let's talk to Annie, who's calling from Plymouth. She's been holding for a few minutes. Hi,
oh, okay,
Annie.
Okay, great.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had a question about encouraging the birds that I'd like to have to come to my feeder as opposed to the ones that I wish would not.
Mm-hmm.
I have two feeders out, and this late spring, a huge flock of grackles came by. Usually they'll come by and leave, but this time they've come by and they stay. Now, I wouldn't mind feeding them, too, if they weren't such pigs. They land on the feeder and they just sit there and eat and eat and eat. The other little birds can't get there. So I wondered, I was hoping they would just go on to somewhere else, but they have not. I wondered if there was any sort of feeder that I could use that would discourage the grackles and the bigger blackbirds and encourage the chickadees and the cardinals and all the pretty small birds. I don't want to be prejudiced, but
you know. Yeah, it seems nobody likes those big flocks of blackbirds that come in and rip up, eat everything on the feeder and scare the little birds away. A suggestion or a possibility, you may... Those blackbirds, I'm surprised they didn't move on, because the grackles now should be starting to nest, and the red-winged blackbirds, grackles nest in pine trees. And once they start incubating, the male will switch over. They'll start eating, and of course when they feed their young, they don't feed them seeds, they feed them insects. So there really should be a lull. They'll go away at least for a month or so. They sell these feeders that come in like a little cage, then they hang in the middle, so only the birds of a certain size, like chickadees, goldfinches, house finches, nuthatches, pine warblers. Some of the mesh, though, is tough, and it's depending on the size, it will keep. Northern cardinals don't seem to like to go through it, so they're not much different in size really than a red-winged blackbird. So it's kind of a. I'd suggest that maybe you keep the feeders up you have, and add a feeder that has a baffle or a cage around it to keep out the larger birds.
Yeah, good idea.
But otherwise, you know, it's kind of you take the ones that you like with the ones you don't like.
Yeah, can't do much about that. Annie, thanks for the call. Catherine is calling from Woods Hole. Hi, Catherine.
Hi, Mindy. How are you?
Good.
So I have a woodpecker question.
Sure.
Excellent.
The downies seem to have found a number of downspouts around the neighborhood and are working hard on them. And I'm just wondering if they're just marking out their turf or if this is something else that they're doing, because they seem to, you'll hear one at the neighbor's house and then you'll hear one a distance off working on the downspouts, making a tremendous amount of noise.
Little bird making a lot of noise.
They look, they love to make a racket, and it's exactly as you said, your first choice there. They are just advertising. Right now is It's prime time. They may not have a mate yet, so they're attracting their... They basically have a territory that's rectangular, and they'll have four sound posts or four areas that they'll go to in the morning, really early, mm-hmm. and then again late, right just before dark. And that advertises, and they'll get up there. I mean, they'll bang it on antennas, downspouts, whatever makes the most noise, that's what they're going to go for. They're like crazed drummers, and they seem to know what's going to make the most noise because that's a little tiny bird. And if you hear the drumming noise they make, it's hard to believe that that bird can generate that much sound. And I actually think it's great. The good news is you're going to stop hearing that within 2 to 3 weeks, if not sooner.
Okay. Well, I don't mind it so much. It's just This is new. We haven't had I haven't noticed one for a number of years here doing this. So
well, it's you sound like you're very attentive because if you hear the one drum and then you hear the response. If you listen even harder, I'll bet you could hear as many as four. They'll go in succession, you know. It's like a little
right down
symphony.
The line. Yeah. Right. It's like I'm still here. This is my territory.
Yeah. And that's what happens. The reason birds use sound, woodpeckers use drumming, but most birds, the reason they get up really early and sing is that's how they defend their territories. It prevents a lot of fighting. They don't actually have to fight. They just get up and sing. And then other birds of their species knows that they're alive and defending that territory. But then, say, later in the morning, let's talk, like, say there's a robin on a singing post. Later in that morning, a Cooper's hawk grabs the robin and eats it off a lawn somewhere. Well, boom, that night, there won't be in other words, the songs will be missing right away, and there are basically what's floaters. There are other robins in the population that'll quickly slide in and take over that territory and they'll actually breed. I mean, it's amazing how fast they can get replaced.
Interesting.
So that's the purpose of birds' song, is to let them know that that territory is being actively defended and that there is a bird there. As soon as that song stops, then another bird will move in.
Captain, thanks for the phone call.
Great, thank you.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. I'm Indy Todd. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the latest bird news with ornithologist Vernon Locks. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number for your bird comments or questions. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Vernon, we've got an email from Beth who says, a great crested flycatcher frequents my deck. He lies flat, spreads out his wings and tail so he looks like a disc, and opens his mouth wide, showing bright red. The deck is in the sun and gets hot. What's up?
Wow. That'd be great to get some pictures of.
Yeah.
It sounds like the bird is, you know, birds spend a great deal of time taking care of their feathers, which they depend on for everything, for insulation, for warmth, to be able to fly. And this bird sounds like it is actually taking a sun bath. It's going, or it's some kind of, it's weird that it opens its mouth. I mean, I don't know if there was a female, if that's some sort of display going on. I'd be curious if this bird did this, is it still doing it? Or has it already got it, you know, or did it stop? It's almost like a lot of birds take dust baths, and a lot of birds, of course, they bathe in water. This thing sounds like it was taking a sun bath on her deck. Maybe it was hot enough to get rid of some of the little feather mites and things, parasites that they get. But I guess the answer to that, without seeing some pictures or watching it myself, I'm not exactly sure what that bird was doing.
So we'll have to ask.
But it sure sounds great. I wish I'd seen it.
Another thing that's happening now, which we usually—I won't be surprised if somebody calls and asks us about this—but the birds are seeing their own reflection, and they don't realize it's a reflection. So we see a lot of this where they're like, you know, attacking your side mirror on your car, or maybe the reflection in the window.
I got 15 emails about that this week. You know what's going on there, don't you?
Yeah. Yes, they think it's a competition, trying to get rid
exactly.
of that competition.
Birds don't understand mirrors, and in nature, there's almost no. They might see their reflection on really smooth water, but when they're going to drink or bathe, they don't see that as a threat. But when they this time of year, even any window, depending on the angle of the sun, can reflect back the bird's reflection. And right now, their endocrine systems are just running overboard. I mean, a bird's gonads actually increase 100 times from what they go vestigial because they don't need the weight during the fall and winter. But right now, right as they're getting ready to defend territories and find a mate and lay eggs, they get, they're all hormone-filled crazy birds, if you will.
Yeah.
And so the males particularly, although females do it too, when the male sees its reflection in anything, it looks like a rival male, and he will throw himself at that bird to drive it out of the territory. That's why birdsong is so neat. They don't have to fight, but when they come up against a reflection, they've got nothing. Their only choice is either stand and fight or flee, and they're going to stand and fight every time at this time of year.
Yeah.
So that's what's going
on. That's what's happening. All right.
So how you make that go away is either shade somehow, shade. And if this is happening at your house or at your car mirror or one of your windows, check the angle of the sun. Check what time of day that this happens, because the days are getting longer. So it'll actually, like if it happened at 3:30 in the afternoon, tomorrow it might happen at 3:31 or 3:32. There might be a way you could put something in front of that to keep the sun from hitting it, or put up, darken the window, do something so it wouldn't reflect so much, or even put some masking tape on the window for just, for a couple of weeks. This won't last very long.
All right. Libby is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Libby.
Oh, hi. Good morning.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, sure. We can hear you. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a cell phone tower where I post my house, and we've had 3 pairs of ospreys trying to make their nest there. There's always the one pair that comes back every year. And now I know there's been a problem with the osprey, so now there's just the one pair left, I think. However, back in the fall, I saw the men from the cell phone company, I think, clearing away the old nest. So when the birds were flying around the past month or so, they never seemed to be able to land on the cell, on the tower. So I figured they weren't going to be able to make a nest. Now this morning, I think I finally saw one had been able to land. My question is it too late for them to start mating and building a nest? I kind of would be happy if they went somewhere else because they're so noisy.
I love the lilt in your voice, by the way. That's terrific. Yes, as you suspect, it's actually is too late right now for the ospreys. Any osprey that's going to nest successfully this year basically had to have a mate and eggs going by like the 15th of April. And then what happens, I think you're looking, and then, young ospreys go to South America, they stay there they don't come back until generally the second summer they'll return. They probably don't nest until they're 4 or 5 years old in many instances. And they play, they're like teenagers playing house, and it turns out the most successful breeding ospreys are the oldest ospreys, and they're the ones that have the most experience at catching fish in different weather conditions. And so cell towers are a problem for both the owners of the cell towers and the ospreys. They go to the highest structure they can find, basically, and so that's why they try to nest on them. And they do nest on them successfully in some places, but eventually, ospreys will keep adding to their nest every year until they become enormous, and at some point there's going to be a conflict. So I think what you're watching now is some teenagers practicing, or pairs that aren't going to be successful. So they like the view from up there. It's probably a good place to eat fish, but I think they'll give up on the nesting stuff very soon.
All right, Libby.
Let's hope.
So Libby, hopefully your neighborhood will be a little bit more quiet.
Yeah.
They are noisy, although I don't mind them so much, but I know some people don't like the noise they make.
That funny high pitch.
Yeah, if it's really close to you, Libby, thanks for the call.
Males will have a fish, and they'll keep doing that display for hours during the middle of the day, flying up, going. I think it's terrific myself.
Yeah,
it doesn't last.
Yeah, it doesn't last
long. It's
only
going to be.
But we went on a vacation to Florida a few years ago, and there was a osprey nest literally right outside the living floor was on the second floor, so you could look from the dining room window right into this osprey nest, which was really cool.
Yeah.
But it started squawking awful early in the morning, so I can see where that would get annoying if you had that all the time. All right, Michael is calling from Chatham. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning. Thanks for my call.
Sure.
I enjoy your show very much.
Thanks.
Great.
I'd like some tips about attracting hummingbirds. I made my own feeder and wrapped some red bright tape around it and drew some petals of what I hoped was a flower. But I haven't seen any yet. It's been up about a week. Could it be that my feeder isn't bright red enough, or there just are no hummingbirds in my neighborhood?
Well, yeah. Could I ask you a couple of questions? Whereabouts in Chatham do you live? Are there big trees in your near you?
Well, yeah, lots. There's a big depression between me and the next house. There's lots of trees and bushes and all kinds.
Are you up in North Chatham somewhere? Or?
Yeah. No, actually, we're in between like the Oyster River and Stage Harbor, a little spit of land.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That's not great hummingbird habitat. That's for sure. Have you seen hummingbirds in your yard? Coming to flowers or anything else?
Oh, last year I saw maybe one or two.
Right. Yeah, I think the problem is you have a very low density. There are very few hummingbirds where you live there. It sounds like you're doing everything right. Do you have flowers planted as well that will be coming up, like bee balm or things that hummingbirds like?
Some of them ones that seem to attract the hummingbirds last year, you know, aren't in bloom yet, but there's all kinds of rose bushes near where I placed the hummingbird feeder.
Well,
but of course,
you know, I've had the best luck with the cheapest hummingbird feeder I can buy, these little ones you buy at the store for like $3 and hang. Hummingbirds love them.
Mm-hmm.
They're little round disc and they have four little holes and a little railing around, and the hummingbirds just, I don't know, they... Of course, Nantucket has, where I live, there's like no hummingbirds. So we get a couple, we've had two this year, this spring, but they're gone now. And then I don't expect, I'll probably take the hummingbird feeders down and put them up again starting late August when migrants might come through and leave them up into the fall, because sometimes we get these rare western strays that show up. But In your instance, I would say don't give up yet. And maybe put up another hummingbird feeder. It's always, I think, I don't know, I've had, they like to have at least two for some reason. And then they'll go to one, they'll spend more time if there's another food source right nearby, and then you're more likely to see them. Because how often do you stare at this feeder all day long?
Just about.
The problem is the hummingbirds come in and they're there 3, 4, 5 seconds and then they're gone.
Yeah.
And you don't see them again. So you really... Sometimes I just get crazy. You know, you have to sit there and stare at the feeder for a long time.
You know, Michael,
if they were visiting your feeders, they should be there first thing in the morning and again late in the day.
Yeah. Michael, I had the same problem where, you know, I mentioned earlier I saw those Baltimore Orioles, but then I've been watching the feeders and I didn't see the hummingbird, but my husband kept seeing it. Well, why aren't I seeing this hummingbird? And then finally it was like 5 o'clock in the afternoon. It was going between my three hummingbird feeders. I was like, finally. So now that's about the time of day I see them coming in. It's about 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
You have three feeders.
I have three.
Yeah. See, that's, for some reason, it seems the more hummingbird feeders you put up, the better, you know, the more they like it. So
yeah.
If you're going to take the time to make the nectar, it's no big deal to make it, to put in a couple more little feeders, you know.
I'll give that a try.
All right.
Thanks, Michael. Thanks for the call.
Good luck.
866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Before we move on from hummingbirds, something else we should mention. We talked about making our own nectar, but you don't recommend using the red stuff. That red dye. Yeah.
No, I don't. I don't recommend any of the commercial. You just make it.
Yeah, sugar.
You buy
water.
Sugar and make your own. Do you cook your hummingbird nectar?
Nope.
You don't?
Nope.
Okay.
I just stir it up and dissolve it in the water and then put it out there.
Okay.
Why? Are you supposed to cook it?
No, I don't. I know Trish cooks it.
Yeah.
Huh. And that's some people cook theirs and some don't. That's
yeah.
I think it seems to work either way.
Yeah. And how often do you change your sugar water?
Well, it's, you know, as it gets hotter and, it, you know, keeping the bees out and there's all those other things. I guess every 2 or 3 days.
Okay.
If it starts to look, you know, if it starts looking nasty at all, I change it.
Yeah, it's been cool, so I've been changing it once a week. But yeah, as it gets warmer,
right,
I probably have to do it all.
Some people change it every 2 days, and then some people change it when it runs out. You know, so
yeah.
I think, of course, you don't want to give the hummingbirds bad nectar.
No,
you know?
Not at all.
they're so tiny.
We want to help
them along.
Give
them the good stuff. Give them the good stuff.
All right, Pat is giving us a call from Dennis. Hi, Pat.
Hey, how are you doing, Mindy?
Good.
Good. It seems to be all about the birds that I'm interested in today. I just had the annual event of I was out on my deck and my hummingbird female showed up, just kind of buzzing the window, like, sort of, where is my feeder?
Nice.
Within 5 minutes, of course, I had her feeder up, and she was back, and she's sticking around. So, I was going to tell you, the short answer to Bert's question about it is you're in for the long haul. Keep it up all summer.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. They'll keep coming, and then you get the migrants in the fall. It'll have the little wars in your yard.
Yeah. Yeah, like I said, I get a lot of them for the flowers that I have, but you think they'll do the feeders as well as the flowers then,
all
huh?
All summer long.
Oh, good.
My males haven't showed up yet, but I've got a couple of feeders, and they'll be along soon.
Oh, great. Okay.
Whereabouts are you located?
I'm on the south side of Dennis. I'm in Dennisport. Up by the
okay, and you've got hummers. Good.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
For years and years, and they, like I say, they come back right to the window, sort of looking at me, waiting for the...
So it makes you think it was the bird that was there last year nesting.
It's been happening for so many years that I always think I've got maybe some part of the same family because of the way they just show up at that window and then just come right back the minute the feeder's up.
Oh, that's funny.
All right, that's great. That's great.
They're asking for the food.
I'm also the person who keeps reporting on the ospreys at the Rotary, Rotary.
Yep.
I sent an email in about a month ago. Well, that young juvenile pair from last year has got a very successful nest going.
Oh, great.
I reported in on it about a month ago, and it was really kind of shabby looking, but they've really done a nice job, and they're there. So there's two poles there.
The eggs will be hatching any day.
Yeah.
I'll try to stop it, but there's a little cul-de-sac there. You can watch them with binoculars.
Yeah, and Pat, we do appreciate you updating us. We do get those emails, and I do pass them along to Vern. So thanks for updating us on that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, thanks.
They're doing great.
Okay, thanks for the call, Pat. Jane is calling from McCoit. Hi, Jane.
Hello, Mindy. I have a question for Vern about whether they are better in a sun or shady spot, the hummingbird feeders.
Okay.
I have one, and they seem to like the shade better.
Oh.
That's an interesting question, because the ones I have get sort of half sunned and then half shade in the afternoon, depending. I think the nectar keeps better in the shade. Mm. Doesn't get hot, and you get less bees and less insect activity. So perhaps the shade, if you have a choice, I think I'd go with the shade.
Good idea.
Of course, most of the flowers that they nectar on in the summer and stuff are in full sun. So, but once they find it, they're visual hunters, if you will. And once they find the hummingbird feeder, it doesn't really matter where it is, they will go to it. So I think it's easier to keep the nectar and stuff if it stays cool.
I think they were both in the sun. Yeah. And I'm sort of doing an experiment now. I think I'll leave them one and one for a while and see
what happens.
Keep an eye on them.
Yeah, Jane, let us know.
Good idea.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeendislands.org. We'll have more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with ornithologist Vernon Lux. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And Joan is calling from East Harwich. Hi, Joan.
Good morning, Mindy, and good morning, Vern.
Good morning.
A very weird story.
Oh, good.
On December 4th, I was going out for the papers early in the morning, and at the end of the driveway was a gray object with a black neck and head, and it, all of a sudden it turned its face and looked at me. It was a white-faced coot.
Huh.
And then it stood up, because it was laying down at the end of the driveway. It stood up, and it slowly took off, and I followed it down to the end of our street to make sure it made it across Route 28 without getting hit by anything, and it went out towards Pleasant Bay. But I don't have any idea what the heck it was doing laying in the middle of the street.
You didn't get any pictures of this thing, did you?
No, because I didn't know it was there.
Right. I don't know what a white-faced coot is.
Gray. It was about the size of a football, had a black head and neck, and...
Was it like a duck?
Bill and the plate, the front of its bill that goes up the front of its face.
Yeah.
I found it there.
And it was an American coot, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And also, when I was going down to Chatham the other day along by Ryder's Cove, there's an osprey nest up on top of the RCA antenna up there, and an osprey dove off it going after a fish in the cove. And it was in a dive as it passed my windshield, and all of a sudden the wings went into the braking mode and the talons came down into the grabbing mode.
Mm.
And it was quite the sight to see right in front of my windshield.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, Joan, thanks for that. Thanks for sharing those stories with us. That's interesting. Yeah. I don't know what that was. Is that a duck, American coot? What is that?
No, a coot's like a gallinaceous bird. They have really funny feet. I was just curious, when you say the bird took off, did it walk or run, or was it flying?
It flew. It took off running, and then it got airborne very slowly and low, and then it got higher. It had to have gotten much higher by the time it reached the end of the street, but my street has a big curve in it, so it got out of sight before I could see how high it
got.
At the end of the street, it had to clear the wires.
Yeah, wow.
That's pretty crazy.
All right. Thanks, Joan. Thanks for the call. Wayne sends us an email. He says, I live in an area of West Tisbury that has large beech trees and large oak trees, so I'm happy to say that I have orioles. Lucky you. My question is about bluebirds. I have put up at least 8 nesting boxes for bluebirds. I'm happy to say that I have 1 pair using the box near my fruit trees. The rest seem to be inhabited by sparrows, who I do not care for. Occasionally, a chickadee or a swallow will take one over, but the sparrows dominate. Is there a standard that might help attract more bluebirds and discourage sparrows? Is it bad for me to open the box and discard the sparrow nest?
That's a really important email he just sent. I hope he's listening, Wayne. The house sparrows that you're discussing that are nesting in the boxes, they're not sparrows at all. They belong to the weaver finch family, and it's a species that's not native to North America. And it enjoys no federal or state protections. And in fact, you are allowed to eliminate house sparrows anywhere at any time, which is, they're basically a little winged rat that got here. I'm obviously not a fan of them because I also maintain and put up lots of birdhouses. And I have seen, back when I used to live on the vineyard, I had some bluebirds nesting, and several times house sparrows would come in, peck to death the babies that were about to fledge, and build a nest right over their rotting corpses.
Oh,
and
that's awful.
Tell me, that will make you not fond of these birds right away. So when I put birdhouses up, they are not to be used by house sparrows. Just last year, I've just discovered something, though, that actually keeps the sparrows out of the boxes, and tree swallows, chickadees will still use them. And, you know, you don't have to patrol the boxes and keep the sparrows out. And you can, I think you could probably find this online somewhere, but basically you take, on the top of the birdhouse, you put in a couple of little screws or nails. I use screws. And then some rather heavy gauge fishing line, something that's rather thick with a little sinker on it, with sinkers to hold it. And just put the line about an inch and a half. In other words, stick these so this is, maybe I can send a picture and we can post it on the website. That might be easier to see what I'm talking about. And basically you hang the sinkers and the line down over the front of the birdhouse, and that the sparrow, since I've done that, I've had tree swallows use the boxes and never had a sparrow go into any of them.
But the bluebirds can still get in?
What's that?
The bluebirds can still get in?
Well, I don't know how this works because I don't have bluebirds over here. I haven't been able to test it on bluebirds. But I mean, that's great. He's got a pair. The vineyard does have a nice population of bluebirds, and I think he's lucky to have one there with all the big trees
right
out in the orchard. They prefer more open country to nest in.
Well, maybe we're going to have to. Maybe I'm going to have to send you Wayne's phone number so that you can give him a call, and maybe he can experiment.
We could try a few things. Although bluebirds right now, if they're probably feeding young already or about to start feeding young. And then they'll take a week off, and then they'll re-nest again. So, it'd be interesting. Yeah, we're still it's a work in progress. But the sparrows are bad, and you actually are allowed to remove them any way you like. So,
okay, that's good news. Janine in Mashpee is calling. Hi, Janine.
Hi. Yes, my husband 2 years ago built 4 birdhouses and a nesting box for the wintertime, and he. The first year, the only thing we got in it was squirrels, so we repaired them and fixed the holes. The second year, we got nothing, and we're wondering how to attract birds to nest in the boxes.
Where do you live?
We live in Mashpee, and we have a 1-acre lawn with some random scattered trees on it. And under the trees, we have bird baths, and we have bird feeders.
Okay.
And that's where we have the boxes attached.
Do you know the dimensions of the entrance hole to the boxes?
I think it's 1 inch.
1 inch?
Yeah, 1 inch is really small, and the only things that can get in a 1 inch hole really are a black-capped chickadee and a house wren. Tree swallows, nuthatches, titmice, they require an inch and a half diameter hole.
Okay.
So really you've only got those boxes at that size. There's only two, you know, chickadees might use them, but even that, I would change the size of the holes, and then mounting them is really important, the way you put them up. Out here, because mammalian predators, raccoons in particular, they can climb up a box. They've even climbed osprey poles and eaten the babies or killed the adults. Raccoons are incredibly tough. You've got to make it predator-proof as well, which a lot of birds won't use a box if it looks like they... I don't know how these are mounted. I use a 10-foot galvanized pipe, 3/4 inch, that I drive into the ground like 4 feet and put the boxes up about 6 feet high. And that keeps everything, even snakes can't climb up it.
With that, because the raccoons can climb the trees. Okay.
Right, and that's, like, it sounded like when you had squirrels, you didn't build a big box for screech owls, did you? Because you might get screech owls there. But the big problem with the screech owl box.
Nesting box for nesters for the winter.
Uh-huh. You mean a roost? And in the winter, birds will come in and roost in those boxes for protection. Like I have a couple of downy woodpeckers that come into the same box every night for years now.
Hmm.
Just during the winter, they don't nest there. They just come in because it's nice shelter
get out of the bad cold.
But anyway, try a couple of things. There's a lot of information on how to do this online. If you just Google, you know, birdhouses Northeast Cape Cod or something, and see what comes up.
Yep. Janine.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
All right. Christy in Dennisport says, good morning. I was just getting up to cook my sugar water for the Hummer that just came to the window just now and turned on the radio to hear you. Anyway, we have a bald male cardinal. No feathers at all. What's the problem?
That's a funny thing that happens to cardinals rather routinely at this time of year. And it's just on the bird's head. They look like some Grateful Dead poster from the past with a skull. It's like a skull on a real colorful bird. They get all these feathers. They're actually growing new feathers right now. And fortunately, because there's no insulation on their head, it doesn't matter so much this time of year because they're able to stay warm. If they're bald in the winter, it's a big problem for them because then they have to eat like 3 times more food just to maintain their body heat. It's caused by a variety of things. Usually it's these feather mites that eat their heads, or maybe it stuck its head into something that was rather nasty and caused the stuff to clot, and then they just fell out. But actually, at the feeders around here, there's one cardinal with the same condition, and it is fairly common in cardinals. But it shouldn't actually affect the bird at all. And you watch if you keep watching, I'll bet within another month or less, that bird will be fully feathered again.
All right.
All right.
Henrietta and Tom Wright, we awoke this morning to find a dead northern parula on our deck. How common are they on the Cape? We live in Hatchville and have not seen one before.
Ah, well, that's too bad. That's a beautiful little wood warbler, a northern parula. They're blue on the back, bright yellow. I mean, they're shocking. They look like these little jewels.
Hmm.
They're not very common on the Cape. There's a few that breed. They have a real distinctive song that goes with a little hiccup at the end. And they nest in several places. There's actually one place on Nantucket where they breed, but they're really common as you go inland from here, and they breed all across the state of Maine. They're really common up in Maine. They like big trees and wetlands. They like red maple swamps. They like to make their nest out of the lichens, the little like Spanish moss type stuff that grows in wet swamps. But it's I think what happened there was you had a migrant parula warbler heading north, and sadly it hit the window.
Yeah,
that's too bad, but... They're lovely birds, and you can even, if the bird's in good shape, I don't know if you put it in your freezer or not, but certainly a lot of places, that bird, we can learn something from it. If you bring it to the Wellfleet Bay Wildlife Sanctuary, or even the long pasture in over in Barnstable, they can get it up to the Museum of Comparative Zoology at Harvard, where the bird will enter the permanent collection, where they have something like, I forget, I think it's like under a million dead. There's species there that are hundreds of years old. In fact, they have a whole drawer full of ivory-billed woodpeckers, which are extinct. Wow. And what's fascinating is now with the new technology that keeps evolving and emerging, like there's birds that John James Audubon shot in the collection up at the Museum of Comparative Zoology, and they can take a little sample. They can take some DNA off like the foot of this specimen, and they can find out stuff about the atmosphere and climate change and stuff that you just, it sounds like science fiction what you can find out. So to have these repositories of these skins, they call museum specimens, is very valuable. And of course, we're not killing birds anymore, thank goodness, for museum stuff. So getting specimens is rather hard. So yeah. If anyone listening to this, you have a bird slam into a window or is otherwise it's dead but in good shape, put it in a baggie, write down the date and put it in your freezer, and hopefully, and then you can either call the radio station or call Mass Audubon, one of the sanctuaries, and perhaps you could drop it off or someone might even be able to pick it up, and it will make its way to one of these museums where it will be a permanent source of information for
Ariane has two questions. Her first is, I have small black birds, not grackles, but they flock and they make a wonderful sound like water dropping into a pool. Are these starlings?
If they must be.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think whether.
What else is about small black bird? Yeah.
Well, they're not that. I don't think starlings are that small myself. And do they, you know, the bill, and of course they have no tail, but the noises she's describing sound like starlings.
Okay. Secondly, I sit on my deck and meditate in the evening, and often birds come and sit on me. I've been lucky so far, no one has done anything else on me. My question is, I have long, fine, curly, light hair, and in the spring there is some sort of small bird that lights on my head, and after seeming to pick and choose what they want, they pull out strands of my hair and fly away. I'm assuming for nests? I would think for nests, right? That's what they're doing?
Well, the bird that does that all the time on the Cape, I've had them land on my head, are black-capped chickadees, the state bird of Massachusetts and Maine. How do you get to be the state bird? They asked all the fourth graders many years ago what their favorite bird was, and of course everyone knew what a chickadee was, so the black-capped chickadee won. They nest in cavities, in holes in trees, they'll nest in nest boxes, they'll nest in amazing situations, and they like to line their nests with hair. And they are so fearless, humans don't exist to them. They'll come land and just start pulling hair off. I've had it happen to me on Morris Island in Chatham, up in the beach forest in Provincetown, on the way to Nauset Coast Guard Beach. And apparently wherever she lives, if you stay still, they must love her hair, and they come and pull some out for their nest.
Well, that was going to be my question. You're standing still when this happens, right?
I've had them light on me when I'm walking.
Really?
If you're not wearing a hat, they'll come. Yeah, they don't care. They'll just come and, you know. Of course, they like longer hair, I think, so.
Yeah, of course.
It hasn't happened to me. I just got a haircut.
So right. You probably don't have to worry about it. Well,
right.
And they're one of my favorite birds, those little chickadees. They're so cute.
Yeah, they're
so
fantastic.
Cheery.
Yeah,
yeah. And they're always the first one at the bird feeders when you put them up. The other birds watch them to see and as you know, I mean, we follow the chickadees to see where the other birds are.
That's exactly right.
Ornithologist Vernon Locks joining us from our studio at the Linda Loring Nature Foundation on Nantucket. As always, thank you, Vern.
Thanks, Mindy. Have a great Memorial Day weekend, everybody.
You too. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vince produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.